Piano Sonata in B minor by Franz Liszt, played at Wigmore Hall in London last Monday by the Ukrainian pianist Valentina Lisitsa. In an hour's time, we'll be going live to Chester Cathedral for choral evensong. And then at 4 o'clock in the choir, Sarah Moore Peach will be looking at the modern revival of West Gallery music. That's 4 o'clock this afternoon here on Radio 3. And now, as part of our 18th century season, here's Lucy Skeeping with this week's edition of the Early Music Show.
Most of us, I guess, when we think of the 18th century, think of words like elegant, refined, or good taste. Just look at some of the clean-lined Georgian terraces and arcades, the beautifully laid-out parks and squares and finely carved furniture. Our ancestors seem to have got things just right, a calm, pleasing, living and working environment. But that was only one side of the story. London was in fact a city of dramatic contrasts. Scratch the surface and you reveal a sometimes horrifying world, noisier, smellier, rougher and, well, more cruel than anything we could imagine in the 21st century. And perhaps no one offers us a more accurate picture of all this than William Hogarth, whose extraordinary catalogue of engravings and paintings provides us not just with snapshots or scenes, but almost uniquely with a narrative as well. You don't just look at Hogarth pictures and admire his craftsmanship, his sense of proportion and so on. He wanted us to read them too, to understand, enjoy and even laugh at the witty satire within. And from the drawing rooms of the prosperous upper middle classes with their powdered wigs and pretensions to the gaming houses, the brothels and filthy crowded streets, Hogarth leaves us in no doubt about the class tensions and cultural issues simmering beneath. Music was one of the defining themes of the Georgian age, whether performed in one of the fashionable new theatres of London's West End or in the dark corner of some rough tavern. So it's not surprising that more than 70 of Hogarth's images include musical references. In today's programme, with the help of the author and musician Jeremy Barlow, we're going to be examining three of those images, starting with The Enraged Musician, where in a packed street scene, Hogarth has given us a great number of characters, buildings and objects to examine. On the left, we see a musician of the highest rank who's stopped playing his violin and is leaning out of his window with his hands over his ears, furiously trying to block out the sounds of the street just outside. Nearest to the open window is a ragged wind player, the bell of his long oboe pointing straight towards the house. A fat drummer boy in the foreground adds to the sound, as does a screeching knife grinder, a raucous ballad singer with a screaming baby in her arms, a yapping dog and a child playing with a rattle of the ear-shattering sort, the kind you whirl round and round. A tall girl with a milk container balancing on her head takes centre stage, just one of several street traders who, to the continued exasperation of our enraged musician, are noisily crying their wares.
These are the cries of London town. Some go up street and some go down.
These now are the cries of London town. Some go up street and some go down.
Those
are the cries of London town.
Some go up street and some go down.
Those are the cries of London town.
Some go up street
and you have any milk, may I ask?
Those are the cries of
I have heart dipping by its
new Wildfleet oysters,
Selection of street cries. Well, many thanks for joining us, Jeremy Barlow. Now, you've made a really in-depth study of the musical references in Hogarth's pictures. And to start, we're looking at his engraving entitled The Enraged Musician. Which part of the 18th century does this actually represent?
Well, he published the print in 1741. He'd been thinking about it a little while before that.
What's the picture basically about?
I suppose it's basically about the contrast in musical culture between the high art of Italian opera and Italian virtuoso fiddlers coming to London, which was appreciated by the rich mainly, because they were the only ones who could afford to hear it, and the people in the street who couldn't afford to hear it, and their own musical culture with the street cries and the song of the ballad seller. This is it, really, high versus low, rich versus poor.
In the picture, as I've already said, there's quite a lot of street trading going on and people crying. Can we sort of pinpoint a few? For instance, on the extreme right, there's a chap knife grinding. Each one of these is making a noise that's upsetting the musician.
I think there are lots of interesting contrasts and links in the picture, and the knife grinder is particularly interesting. Well, he's actually grinding a cleaver because he's diagonally opposite to the musician in the window. And when you think about it, the violinist produces his sound by scraping very beautifully his violin bow across the string, so the sound is produced that way. And the knife grinder makes an absolutely hideous sound by sharpening his cleaver that he's got. So that they both have the same methods of sound production, but they're at the opposite ends of the social scale, and the sounds are completely contrasted, hideous and beautiful.
So Hogarth's already making a point there. It's not just any old street trader. There's a point to it in comparing it to the violinist. There's also buildings here that are making noises. There's a church. Should we imagine there's bells coming out of that?
Well, we should, because on the church there's a flag flying, which indicates a festival, and therefore the bells would be rung. And to the right, there is this building on which Hogarth has written John Long, pewterer. So this is a pewter factory. So there are terrific noises coming from there, from hammering.
But perhaps worse of all for the enraged musician is this ghastly-looking sort of ballad singer on the extreme left with a baby in her arms. Ballad singing was such a big part of London life.
Yes, and it was also illegal because they weren't licensed like city waits were, so they were always in danger of being carted off and arrested, and so it was a precarious occupation, but they really were the very bottom of the pile. So she makes another kind of absolute contrast with this obviously very rich and successful violinist, and actually she forms a triangle with him and with the oboe player that you mentioned. And the oboe player forms another contrast. The oboe isn't an instrument of the streets, but he's wearing a scruffy wig. He's wearing clothes that were once respectable. So he's a professional musician who's fallen on hard times, as opposed to the professional in the window who is so successful.
One very prominent sort of collector and composer, in fact, in this Georgian period, the early Georgian period, was a man called Thomas Durfee, who compiled these six volumes of popular songs from the streets and the theatres called Pills to Purge Melancholy. We heard the Della consort just now with some rather authentic sounding street cries. But in Durfee's Trader's Medley, he's set out, gosh, some 30 or so different cries, but they're all set to one very rollicking popular tune. It's certainly amazing what you could buy on the streets, if we can believe this song. Not only foodstuff, but things like wigs, swords, old shoes, books, writing ink, and there's even someone offering to cut your corns, which sounds rather painful.
Thank you. lawn.
I'll grind your knives to please your wives and bravely cut your corns.
Ripe strawberries here I have to sell with taffety tarts and pies.
I've brooms to sell, will please you well if you'll believe your eyes.
The tinker's come to stop your holes and solder all your cracks. Whate'er you think, his dainty ink and choice of sealing wax.
Come, mate, bring out your kitchen stuff, old rags or women's hair.
I'll sell your pins for coney skins,
come buy my earthenware.
Come taste and buy my brandy wine, 'tis newly come from France.
This powder now is good, I vow, which I have got by chance.
Here's lemons of the biggest size, with eggs and butter too.
Brave news, they say, is come today, if Jones's news be true.
Come buy my honey and my book for cuckolds to peruse.
The attorney man is come again to tell his dames some news.
My plums and damsons very fine with very good mellow pears.
Come buy a charming dish of fish and give it to your heirs.
Old suits or cloaks or campaign wigs with rusty guns or swords.
When whores or pimps do buy my shrimps, I never take their words.
Is pippins lately come from Kent? Pray taste and then you'll buy.
But mind my song and then ere long you'll sing it as well as I.
But mind my song and then ere long you'll sing it as well as I.
The Trader's Medley from Thomas Durfey's Pills to Purge Melancholy, performed by the City Waits. So, Jeremy, we've already sort of closely examined some of the elements that we can see in Hogarth's The Enraged Musician. But like most of these engravings, there are so many layers of other symbolism as well. Tell us a little more about the gentleman at the window, this enraged violinist.
Right. Well, ever since Hogarth is alive, there's been a kind of industry in identifying as a definite person various people in his pictures. And sometimes there's evidence and sometimes it's pure speculation or it's based on some 18th century anecdote. But the various people at the time identified this musician mostly with a man called Pietro Castrucci, who's a forgotten name now, but he was important then because he was the leader of Handel's opera orchestra, the company known as the Royal Academy of Music.
He's certainly dressed very smartly with a sort of very nice frock coat and braids all over it and what looks like a bit of a powdered wig.
The main thing about Castrucci was that he was notorious for his temper. And so this is why the people have thought that he's enraged. But Castrucci was very successful for a while with Handel. But he actually, by the 1740s, he was in dire poverty. Like so many musicians, he ended his life very poor.
Castrucci was also a composer.
A set of violin sonatas and also a set of concerti grossi. Somebody then who was primarily a player would write music really to attract pupils. You know, he published music because music teaching now is not thought of as a very well-paid profession, but it actually was well-paid then. The nobility and the upper classes did pay well. So by publishing, you would attract pupils. That was the idea.
Thank you.
The Handel Festival Orchestra Halle there, directed by Anton Steck, with Pietro Castrucci's Concerto Grosso in A minor, Opus 3. And Castrucci, we think, or it is thought, is probably the very enraged violinist in Hogarth's engraving entitled The Enraged Musician, which we've been looking at. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and I'm with the music historian Jeremy Barlow today, looking at some of the musical references in Hogarth's pictures. And we're moving on now to the second of our three images today. This time it's an interior scene and a rather smart home, from what I can tell. What's the title of it, Jeremy?
This is the second engraving of Hogarth's story in prints and paintings called A Rake's Progress, telling the story of a man who's inherited money and spends it all and ends up mad in Bedlam.
Well, again, this is a bit of a crowded, lively scene. In the centre, a young man looking rather worried. I guess he's the rake in question. Around him are six characters all trying to attract his attention one way or another. One of them's kneeling in front of him, others are trying to talk to him, and one, looking a bit dandyish with a smirk on his face, seems to be on his toes, dancing, I think. The room itself looks very opulent, with paintings on the walls in ornate frames, and over on the extreme left there's an anteroom just at the back where we see a crowd of people waiting, presumably to come and talk to the rake as well. Now, on the extreme left, we see a man at the harpsichord. So, Jeremy, talk us through the musical references, because this fellow in the middle is very important, isn't he, with his dancing?
Yes, he's a dancing master. He's one of several people in the picture who are going to teach this young man, who's inherited all this money, how to be a gentleman. We got a person with a sword who's going to teach him fencing. That's one of the accomplishments a young gentleman should be able to practice. I've got a jockey kneeling on the right. Riding is something else that he must be able to do elegantly. But this dancing master is perhaps the most important of all. Dancing then was so important to a young man. To be able to do it well was absolutely crucial. A little later in the century, for example, we have Lord Chesterfield in the many letters he wrote while his illegitimate son was on a grand tour. And in one of the letters, he said to him, "As you will often be under the necessity of dancing a minuet, I would have you dance it very well. Remember that the graceful motion of the arms, the giving your hand, and the putting on and the pulling off your hat genteelly are the material part of a gentleman's dancing. But the greatest advantage of dancing well is that it necessarily teaches you to present yourself, to sit, stand, and walk genteelly, all of which are of real importance to a man of fashion." We just have no conception of that importance today, but it really was.
And all of which, I imagine, would help him bag perhaps a rich heiress for a wife.
Oh,
yes. Which is partly what it was all about.
Oh, it certainly was.
Tell us a little bit about the minuet itself, the kind of dance.
The minuet was danced by a couple. One needs to understand the structure of a ball then. At the beginning of the ball, one couple at a time would dance a minuet in the middle of this floor, surrounded by all the other guests at the ball, including the other dancers. They would start off at a distance apart and they would gradually approach, take hands in the middle, and they would execute a pattern on the floor, a kind of S or Z pattern, and the way that was done was crucially important. The use of the floor space was as important as the way you held yourself and did the steps.
Whitehall minuet performed by the Broadside Band. I love to imagine the dancing master in this Rake's Progress picture, the sound of his little pochette. Talking of instruments, there is a larger instrument in this picture on the left. As I said, it's a harpsichord, and we can't see the face of the man playing it, but some people have said, haven't they, Jeremy, that it could be a representation of Handel.
Yes, this story comes about from the painting. Hogarth produced this series both as prints on sale to the general public and as a series of oil paintings. Normally, the thing is that the print, and indeed this print does, include much more detail than the painting. But the painting includes one detail that the print doesn't, and that is on the music stand, are written the letters F.H., capitals, and George Friedrich Handel. So the story is that this must be Handel, though art historians believe actually that the letters F, H were added later as if to make this man into Handel. I suppose this man, he wouldn't have taught the harpsichord. The harpsichord was really a woman's instrument then for the amateur. His only role, I suppose, is to provide some kind of background music. But actually, his role for Hogarth is the music on his stand, which is an opera. And the opera is called The Rape of the Sabine. Now, no such opera actually existed then. But what it does, it gives Hogarth a chance to poke fun at the cult of the castrato in London, because on the right-hand page he's got the cast list, the ravishers, he puts there at the top.
That's the one thing they really couldn't do, I suppose. Ravishing.
Because the names of the ravishers are the three leading castrati in London at that time, Carestini, Senesino and Farinelli.
We're going to talk about them in a minute, but whether this is Handel or not, I think we should hear a bit of Handel now. This is suite number 7 in G minor, the Passacai, performed by Sophie Yates on the harpsichord.
Thank you.
Suite number 7 in G minor, Passacaglia by Handel, and that was Sophie Yates on the harpsichord. I'm looking at Hogarth's engravings in today's programme, and this one is the second of the Rake's Progress series, where we see the interior of a rather smart house with a rake in the middle, surrounded by various different characters and lots of musical references. One of them, Jeremy, that is quite intriguing is this sort of long roll of paper that's hanging on the back of the chair of the harpsichordist who may or may not be Handel. What's written on it? Because I know you've examined it with a magnifying glass.
Oh, yes, this is from a newspaper advertisement, slightly embellished by Hogarth himself, of the gifts that were given to Farinelli, who had only recently come to England and was absolutely fated by everybody. Farinelli was one in a long line of castrati that came to England and had been coming to England even since before Handel arrived here and really set the scene for the popularity of Italian opera. Their voices were quite unlike anything that people had heard because they combined great beauty of sound with extraordinary agility. Many castrati arias rattle around as if it's a violinist playing really fast notes. They could do that, and that was one of the things that the audiences so much admired about them. And Farinelli was the most popular of them all, even though he was only here for about 3 or 4 years. And there was a benefit performance. That's when the performer takes all the takings, the theatre manager doesn't. And if you were really popular, then the audience would shower you with gifts as well. And Farinelli was absolutely showered with really expensive little items of snuff boxes and so on, golden snuff boxes. And this is a list from the newspaper of the gifts that he was given. But Hogarth embellishes it because one of the gifts is a snuff box engraved with Orpheus and his magical powers, and it's a gift from Tom Rakewell, from the rake himself, to Farinelli.
So it's a kind of story within a story.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And then at the very bottom, there's a piece of paper at the end of this thin list.
On the floor, I can just see it's under the dancing master's feet.
That's right, yes. And that's based on a woman stood up at one point in a Farinelli performance and shouted, "One God, one Farinelli," which was considered blasphemous, actually. But Hogarth has that in that little piece of paper there.
Thank you.
one of the arias sung by Farinelli. It's by Porpora from his opera Polifemo. And the aria is Nell'intendere il mio ben. And the singer there was Philip Jaruski with the Venice Baroque Orchestra, directed by Andrea Marcon. Well, in today's early music show, we're looking at three different Hogarth engravings. I'm with my guest, Jeremy Barlow, and we're sort of spotting various musical references, both implicit and explicit. Well, we're moving on now to the last of our three Hogarth images. This is a different kind of picture, isn't it, Jeremy, from the previous two? For a start, it's earlier, and of course it's a painting rather than an engraving, and indeed it's an actual scene rather than some kind of imagined satire. What are we looking at?
This is one of Hogarth's several paintings of a scene from The Beggar's Opera, and The Beggar's Opera was really a reaction against Handelian Italian opera produced in 1728. It was in English. It had short, snappy songs based on popular tunes. It had dialogue. It was really a play with music. You could call it the first musical. But it was, in being the opposite to Italian opera, it was also satirising the form of Italian opera.
And we're going to hear the overture now.
Yes, the overture is interesting. It starts off like a sort of typical, strongly dotted French overture of the period, and then it goes into a fast fugue. And that fugue is based on a tune from the opera, and as far as we know, that's it's the first time an opera overture actually contains a tune from the opera to come. And that tune is called Walpole. Walpole was the first minister, known as our first prime minister, and was very unpopular with many people then. And it really gives a hint of the satire on corruption in government and politics at the time.
Thank you. the overture to The Beggar's Opera, performed by the Broadside Band, directed by Jeremy Barlow, with whom I'm looking today at various Hogarth engravings and paintings. We're looking at The Beggar's Opera painting. Why should Hogarth have wanted to create a picture of a scene from an opera?
This is really not a standard opera, and I think Hogarth was very taken by the satire in it. And also at this point in his life, he was just 30. He'd made his name, really, as an engraver, a satirical prince, and he now wanted to develop his career into oil painting. And he used a scene from The Beggar's Opera, really, to launch himself as an oil painter.
In some ways, this must be the sort of climactic scene, in the sense you've got Macheath now in his leg irons, he's finally been caught, and the two women he's been stringing along, Lucy and Polly, begging their respective fathers to allow him, to let him off?
Yes, that's right. It's the only scene in the whole opera where you get the five main protagonists, as you say, Macheath, Polly, Lucy and their fathers, Peachum and Locket, together in one scene. So and of course it is a crucial moment in the show. He's about to be taken off for trial, and of course he'll be sentenced to death.
What's really interesting is that we see Lavinia Fenton here, the very young actress who played Polly Peachum. What's the story behind this?
The story links to the man sitting on the far right as part of the on-stage audience. When a show was very successful, the manager just piled the audience onto the stage, and he's sitting right at the front, so he's of high rank. He was said to be the man of highest rank and lowest reputation, the Duke of Bolton. And he fell in love, I don't know if you call it love, but anyway, he fell for Polly Peachum. And this was done after the first run, this late picture in 1729. And what you can see is that Polly Peachum, instead of looking up at her father to plead with him for her release, as she has done in the earlier pictures, she is looking across at the Duke of Bolton, and he's looking at her, because she became his mistress. He whisked her away after the first run, and she never performed on stage again.
This was a really milestone cultural event, The Beggar's Opera. It was an amazing satire, and its own satirical nature is something that Hogarth could really relate to, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, there are two aspects to the satire. One is the fact that it's an antithesis to Italian opera in every way, but the other is that it is making parallels between criminals and politicians, something, of course, we don't do today.
But it was this satire on Italian opera and on this sort of overblown, fashionable, virtuoso Italian music that we can also recognise in the first engraving that we saw, The Enraged Musician. Yeah. There's a reference to it, isn't there, on the wall of the Italian musician's house?
Yeah, well, this is a late addition by Hogarth in the second state of the print. He put up a poster for The Beggar's Opera, and the poster lists the cast list of the first production in 1728, even though The Enraged Musician was published in 1741. So it's another insult to Castrucci, because, of course, Castrucci was thrown out of work because Handel's Italian opera company went into insolvency through the success of The Beggar's Opera.
So it's a bit of a neat circle. Well, I think we should finish today with some more music from The Beggar's Opera, and indeed the music that is being performed in the scene that we're looking at in this fabulous Hogarth painting. It's the prison scene, and it's performed, Jeremy, by your Broadside Band. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. What would you have me say, ladies? You see, this affair will soon be at an end without my disobliging either of you.
But the settling this point, Captain, might prevent a lawsuit between your two widows.
Which way shall I turn me? How can I decide? Wife's a lady or the death are as fond as a bride. One wife is too much for most husbands to hear, but two at a time there's no mortal can bear. This way and that way, and which way I will, what would come for the one t'other wife would take ill? This way and that way, and which way I will, what would come for the one t'other wife would take ill?
But if his own misfortunes have made him insensible to mine, a father sure will be more compassionate. Dear, dear sir, sink the material evidence and bring him off at his trial. Polly upon her knees begs it of you.
Is hardened, sure you, sir, will have more compassion on a daughter. I know the evidence is in your power. How then can you be a tyrant to me?
Macheath's time is come, Lucy. We know our own affairs, therefore let us have no more whimpering or whining.
Ourselves like the great to secure a retreat. When matters require it, must give up our gang. Ourselves like the great to secure a retreat. When matters require, must give up our gang. And good reason why, for instead of a fry, impeach a man die, like poor petty rascals might hang, hang. Like poor petty rascals might hang. And good reason why, for instead of a fry, in night and die, like
rascals might hang.
Set your heart at rest, Polly. Your husband is to die today. Therefore, if you're not already provided, it is our time to look about for another. There's comfort for you, you slut.
We are ready, sir, to conduct you to the Old Bailey.
The charge is prepared, the lawyers are met, the judge is all arranged, a terrible show. I go undismayed. For death is a debt on demand, so take what I owe. Then farewell, my love, dear charmers, adieu. Contented I die, 'tis a better for you. Here ends all dispute, the rest of our lives. For this way at once I please all my wives. Then farewell, my love, dear charmers, adieu. Contented I die, 'tis a better for you. Here ends all dispute, the rest of our lives. For this way at once I please all my wives.
The prison scene from The Beggar's Opera by John Gay and Christopher Pepusch. We heard Adrian Thompson as Macheath, Charles Daniels as Peachum, Bronwyn Mills was Polly, Anne Dawson, Lucy, and Richard Jackson, Lockett. The Broadside Band was directed by Jeremy Barlow, who was also Lucy Skeeping's guest on the Early Music Show. The producer was Chris Wines. And today's edition of the Early Music Show is also available as a podcast. This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after 3 o'clock. Time on this Easter day to go live to Chester Cathedral for a festal evensong. The canticles were written by William Walton for the 900th anniversary of Chichester Cathedral in 1975, and the anthem is by the French Renaissance composer Jean L'Héritier, Surexit Pastor Bonus. The Good Shepherd who laid down his life for his sheep has risen. Alleluia. At the end of the service, the choir sings Herbert Howell's setting of the Te Deum, written for the choir of King's College, Cambridge, in 1944. And they begin with an introit by the late Renaissance Venetian composer Giovanni Bassano, which refers to the first witnesses in the Easter Gospel story to Christ's empty tomb, Dic Nobis Maria. Tell us, Mary, what did you see on your way? The tomb of Christ, who is alive, and I saw the glory of his rising.
Thank you.
A very warm welcome to Chester Cathedral on this day of Easter joy and new hope. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who in his great mercy has given us new birth unto a living hope by the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead.
Lord, open thou our lips,
and our mouth shall show forth thy praise.
O God, make speed to save us.
O Lord, make haste to help us.
Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
Praise ye the Lord.
Office hymn, The Lord is Risen Indeed. Psalm 66, sung by the choir.